Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a woman who had to cross an ocean just to get her hands on the yoke. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar, where we spend a little time every day with the people and the machines that made this whole business of flying what it is. And today we're going all the way back. Back before the airlines. Back before you could walk up to a flight school with a checkbook and a medical and come out the other side a pilot. Back to a time when the door to aviation was open for some folks and bolted shut for others. Her name was Bessie Coleman. And the story of how she got her license is one of the most stubborn, hard-headed, magnificent pieces of aviation history I know. Before I get into it, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And after you hear this one, you might just think about what Bessie would have carried in her pocket. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. It's the 1890s in a little town called Atlanta, Texas. Not the big Atlanta, a dusty spot up near the Louisiana line. Bessie is born in 1892, one of 13 children. Her father was part Cherokee, part black. Her mother picked cotton, and so did Bessie, from the time she was big enough to drag a sack down a row. Think about that world for a second. This is the American South, decades before anybody in that cotton field had ever seen an airplane. The Wright brothers hadn't even flown yet. When Bessie was a girl, the airplane did not exist. Nobody on earth had done it. So the idea that this child, in that field, under that sun, would one day be spoken of in the same breath as the great aviators, that was not a dream she could have had, because the thing itself hadn't been invented. But here's what she did have. She could do arithmetic. She was sharp. Her mother would send her to town to settle up with the man who bought their cotton. And Bessie would catch him shorting the family and call him on it. A little girl, doing the books, refusing to be cheated. Keep that picture in your head. It tells you everything about what came later. She wanted more than that field. She walked 4 miles each way to a one-room schoolhouse. She read everything she could get. And when she was old enough, she scraped together a little money and went off to college in Oklahoma. And the money ran out after one term, and she came home. But she wasn't going to stay home. So around 1915, she does what a lot of young folks did in those years. She heads north. She goes to Chicago, to the south side where her brothers had already landed, and she gets work as a manicurist in a barbershop on the Stroll, on State Street. And that barbershop? That's where the airplane finally walks into her life. Because this is right around the First World War. The pilots are coming home from France, and her brother John, who'd served over there, liked to needle her. He'd come into the shop and tell her about the women he'd seen in France. French women, he said, who could fly airplanes. Something you'll never do, he told her. Just ribbing his sister. Now here's where it gets interesting. Most people, you say that to them, they laugh it off. Bessie took it like a dare and never put it down. She decided she was going to fly. Not someday. She got it in her head and she went at it like she'd gone at that cotton buyer's arithmetic. And she ran straight into the wall. She went to flight schools. American flight schools. And the answer was no. It was no because she was a woman. And it was no, harder, because she was black. There was not a flight instructor in the United States in 1920 who would put Bessie Coleman in an airplane and teach her to fly it. The door was bolted. Nobody was going to unbolt it for her. A lot of people. That's the end of the story right there. That's the part where the dream dies quiet. And nobody ever hears the name. But remember, her brother had said France. And Bessie had been paying attention. She found a man named Robert Abbott. Now, Robert Abbott is a name you ought to know. He founded the Chicago Defender, one of the most important black newspapers in the country. Powerful man, real influence. And Bessie went to him, and Abbott told her the same thing her brother had, but he meant it as a roadmap instead of a taunt. In France, he said, they'll teach you. The French don't care that you're a woman, and they don't care that you're black. Go to France. So think about what she does now. She's a manicurist. She does not have money. She does not speak French. So she takes a second job managing a chili parlor to stack up cash. And at night, she goes and learns French. She sits in a class in Chicago and learns the language of a country she's never seen so that when she gets there, she can understand her flight instructor. Let that land for a minute. That is not somebody chasing a whim. That is a flight plan. That is a person who has looked at the whole route, seen every obstacle, and started knocking them down one at a time. Fuel, language, passage. She solved for all of it. In November of 1920, Bessie Coleman gets on a ship and sails across the Atlantic Ocean to France to learn to fly because her own country wouldn't let her. She ends up at a flying school in a place called Le Crotoy up on the North Coast, run by the Caudron brothers who built airplanes. And I want you to picture what she actually climbed into, because we throw the word airplane around and your mind pictures something with a windshield and a nice enclosed cabin. That is not what she flew. She flew a Caudron biplane trainer, open cockpit. Wood and fabric and wire, wooden propeller up front, engine spitting hot castor oil back into her face. So everybody who flew those things came down soaked in it and half sick from the smell. No brakes worth the name. No radio, of course. No parachute. The wind is right in your teeth at every second. You steer with a stick and a rudder bar and a whole lot of feel in the seat of your pants, because there's precious little on the panel to tell you what the airplane is doing. You learn to fly with your body, and the training was not gentle. During the time she was there, she watched another student die in a crash, right in front of her. She wrote about it later, plainly. She saw it happen and she got back in the airplane. That takes a kind of nerve I'm not sure I've ever had to find in myself. She trained for months. 10 miles she walked to the airfield some days. And on June the 15th, 1921, the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, the international body that certified pilots the whole world over, issued Bessie Coleman her license. And that piece of paper made her the first black woman in the entire world to hold an international pilot's license, not the first in America, the first anywhere. And she got it a good while. Before a lot of famous American aviators, most folks could name got theirs. She beat them to it. From a cotton field in Texas, by way of a barbershop in Chicago, and a chili parlor and a French class and a steamship, she got there first. Now, a license is a license. But Bessie understood something that the great showman of that era understood in the 1920s. A pilot didn't make a living hauling passengers from here to there. There weren't the airlines for it. A pilot made a living putting on a show, barnstorming, wingovers and loops and spins and dives right down at the crowd, close enough to blow their hats off. That's where the money was. And more than the money, that's where the eyes were. So Bessie went back to France, and to Germany and the Netherlands, and she got advanced training. Aerobatics, stunt flying, the hard stuff. Figure eights and tailspins and how to bring an airplane down to the deck and pull it back up. And in 1922 she came home to America, and now the same country that wouldn't teach her had to reckon with her because she came home a star. They called her Queen Bess, some called her Brave Bessie. And the crowds came out by the thousands. She flew air shows up and down the country. Curtis Jennings, mostly the old wartime trainers, everybody was flying in those days, surplus and cheap and forgiving right up until they weren't. She looped them and rolled them and she was good, genuinely good. This wasn't a novelty act. This was a skilled aviator doing hard flying in front of people who'd never dreamed they'd see it. And here's the part where I want you to lean in. Because this is the part that makes Bessie Coleman more than just a name in a record book. She had rules. She would fly a show and she would draw crowds. But she would not fly a segregated show where they made black spectators come in through a separate gate. There was an air show down in her home state of Texas, in Waxahachie, and the organizers wanted two entrances. One for white folks, one for black folks. And Bessie Coleman, the headliner, the reason people bought tickets, told them no, one gate. Everybody comes in the same door, or I don't fly. And they blinked. They let everybody in through the one gate, even if the seating inside was still split. She used the only leverage she had, which was that they needed her more than she needed them, and she used it to pry that door open a crack. And that was the dream she was really flying toward. She wanted to open a flight school, a school for black aviators so that no young man or woman who came after her would ever have to cross an ocean to get what she'd had to cross an ocean for. She lectured in churches and theaters between her shows, showing film of her flying, telling young black audiences that the air was theirs too, that the sky did not check your color at the gate. She was raising the money one talk at a time. She never got to build the school. And I'll tell you how it ended, because you can't tell this story honest without it. On the last day of April 1926, she was down in Jacksonville, Florida, getting ready for a show the next day. She'd bought a Jenny, an old one, and it had been flown down from Texas by her mechanic, a young man named William Wills. That morning, the two of them went up to scout the field and look at where she'd do her parachute jump for the crowd. Wills was flying, Bessie was in the other seat. And here's a detail that will stop your heart. She wasn't wearing her seatbelt. She'd left it loose, leaning out over the edge of the cockpit to look down at the ground and pick her jump spot, and something let go in that old airplane, a wrench, they think, that had been left loose down in the guts of the machine, slid into the controls and jammed them. The Jenny nosed over and went into a dive, and then it snapped into a spin upside down, and with no belt holding her, Bessie Coleman fell from the airplane. She was 34 years old. I'm not going to dress that up. It was a bad airplane, poorly kept, and it took her, The way those old machines took so many of the best in those years, that was the price of the frontier, and it was a brutal one, and she paid it. But here's what I want to leave you with, because this is not a sad story. Not really. Thousands came to mourn her. 10,000 people in Chicago filed past. And that dream of hers, the flight school, other people picked it up and carried it. A few years after she died, black aviators out in Los Angeles started the Bessie Coleman Aero Club. And within a few years, they were putting on the first all-black air show in America, and the crowds came by the thousands, just like they'd come for her. The door she'd pried open with one hand, they threw wide. And it kept going. The men who became the Tuskegee Airmen, the black fighter pilots of the Second World War, they came up in a world that Bessie Coleman had helped make thinkable. For years, black aviators flew over her grave in Chicago and dropped flowers. Every year, a whole community of pilots telling her, up through the air she loved, that they made it, that the door stayed open. That's the thing about a pioneer, and I mean the real meaning of that word. A pioneer isn't just the first one through. A pioneer is the one who cuts the trail so everybody behind them has a road. Bessie Coleman never got the school, never got old, never got the easy years. She'd earned three times over, but she cut the trail. And there are pilots in the air right now, this very afternoon, who are up there because a sharecropper's daughter from Texas refused to take no for an answer, learned French, and bought a ticket on a boat. Next time you're grumbling about the cost of a medical or the wait for a check ride, and Lord knows I've done my share of grumbling, just remember, there was a time the door was bolted shut for a whole lot of people, and it took folks like Bessie Coleman throwing their whole lives against it to knock it down. We fly a little freer because she did. I pulled this story together from the historical record kept by the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and from the reporting first carried all those years ago by the Chicago Defender, the paper whose founder pointed her toward France in the first place. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com, blue skies, and go do something today that scares you a little. Bess would have told you the same. This is Taildragger, and I'll see you back here in the hangar.